Hello and welcome to New Books in African Studies. I'm your host, Nicholas Walton. In every program, we talk about a new book connected with Africa and hear from the author. In this program, there are two authors, Jenny Trinitapoli and Alexander Weinreb, and their book is Religion and AIDS in Africa. It's a book rich in information and analysis on how two of the most important issues in African life affect each other. Here's the interview. Well, joining me from the other side of the Atlantic to talk about their book, Religion and AIDS in Africa, are Jenny Trinitapoli and Alexander Weinreb. So welcome to both of you. Whereabouts are you both sitting?
I'm in State College, Pennsylvania at Penn State University.
And Alex?
I'm at the University of Texas at Austin in the great state of Texas.
Okay, well, Alex, can you continue for a second? Just tell us a little bit about yourself, and Jenny can join in, and then both of you just tell me how you came to be interested in this subject and write the book.
Sure. I'm a sociologist, but I think unlike many sociologists, I specialize in sub-Saharan Africa. And during my doctoral research in Kenya 14, 15 years ago, which was not on AIDS or religion, I started to hear quite a lot about AIDS, and just from people on the ground. And I found myself increasingly surrounded by posters and all sorts of products of the international public health community, which were becoming increasingly oriented to AIDS. At the same time, I also started to hear from people on the ground all sorts of like religious discourses related to this new plague, and they've involved how people were interpreting AIDS and how they were dealing with it. So it sort of lodged itself in my mind. And eventually, I met Jenny. So I'll let her take the story from there.
My entree into this project is slightly different. I had been training as a doctoral student at the University of Texas in the areas of religion and health. And most of that research is focused on the United States. But for a variety of reasons, I had interest in Africa and some other parts of the world, and fortuitously met Susan Watkins, who had been studying AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa, and said that her respondents were always talking about religion and someday she wanted to ask about it. And that's also how I met Alex, and we began to look at the question of the relationship between religion and AIDS in this part of the world, specifically Malawi at that time, in systematic ways, and that's how the project came together.
Well, let's start off with looking at HIV in Africa as a general theme. A lot of places in the world have been affected by HIV and AIDS, but it's absolutely fair to say that nowhere has the effect been quite as catastrophic as in Africa, especially this AIDS belt, which seems to be from some of the southern African states all the way up through the to the more northerly sub-Saharan states. Can you just give us a picture, Alex, of exactly what is, you know, what it's like in figures and what it's like on the ground?
Sure. Well, the AIDS belt actually is mainly southern African countries. So countries like South Africa, Swaziland, Zimbabwe, Botswana. And as you move up a little bit into East Africa, the prevalence drops. So in the primary countries, you have what are thought to be HIV prevalence rates in what's known as the prime ages. So people from their late teens until their early 40s, in the 20 to 25% range. And as you head up into East Africa, so you have national prevalence more in the 10% range. Heading into West Africa, once you get as far west as Senegal, then it really drops down to 1% or so. And so when people talk about AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa, even though we like to think of Africa as this amorphous, no, just it's a place, right? And it's all the same. When it comes to HIV AIDS, like many other things, there are incredibly significant differences between between the areas, and this is one of the starting points for puzzling out, you know, why, especially when HIV is supposed to have emerged in Central Africa, why it's actually much higher in Southern Africa. And you know, this was one of the puzzles which animated our own adventures with it as a scholarly endeavor.
What kind of impact is there on the ground? Because one of the key things about your book, which is very data rich, is that you go beyond the data and you try and find a little bit more granularity. So it's not just the overall picture of what's happening, but you're going down to village level and saying, right, well, whatever the big picture, this is what we find there. What's been the impact upon people's lives? Maybe Jenny, you can answer this.
Sure. I think that the information that Alex summarized about HIV prevalence levels is really helpful for an orientation. But looking at it from the ground is potentially even more important. In Malawi, where HIV prevalence at the time that we started collecting this data was about 14% among the prime age population, the respondents in the rural villages that we were working in were attending about 4 to 6 funerals a month. And that means that they're losing friends and people who are close to them at very high rates. So that's one sort of local metric that's not commonly used in demographic research that we find helpful in terms of estimating the magnitude of the epidemic, the number of funerals that people are attending. Another sort of informal metric that we started conversations about was how much time people that we were working with, our research assistants and local collaborators, were spending visiting friends and family members who were sick, bringing them water, food, helping them with chores around the house. And this was another way that we thought was helpful for estimating just sort of the scale of the epidemic.
One other thing which obviously brings all of this together with your studies is that this particular part of Africa is extremely religious, broadly speaking, especially compared to most other parts of the world, similar to what we were just saying about the level of HIV infection. Can you give us a picture of exactly how religious it is and the kind of role that religion plays in people's lives? Because and it's worth pointing out here that, of course, we're talking about different religions in different places.
Jenny, I'm going to let you do that. You're the true sociologist of religion.
Sure. Well, across the African countries, we have data from almost everyone who responds to standard surveys will identify affiliating with a religious tradition that we would recognize, some branch of Christianity or Islam in particular. Beyond the fact that almost everyone, upwards of 90% across countries, is affiliated with religious traditions, we find that there are very, very high levels of religious involvement. And this is something we measure, for example, by the frequency with which people attend regular religious services. How often do they attend their churches and their mosques? And the levels are very high. Upwards of 80% of people attending weekly or more than weekly in dozens and dozens of countries. And beyond attendance, we find that again, here, about 90% of the population in the dozens of countries that we have data from tell us that religion is very, very important in their lives. And of those three very sort of crude measures of religion and religiosity, we easily conclude that it's a very important part of people's daily lives.
Mm. And what you set out to do in this book was to try and find some kind of empirical account of this of the impact of religiosity on HIV. What kind of broad findings can you kick us off by telling us about?
Well, I think one of the starting points for this was for us was not only are there differences in HIV prevalence between different religious traditions, and then also between different types of communities within any given tradition. But we try to start off with asking how people actually choose to interpret AIDS and its impacts, and this was, you know, this was bouncing off what Jenny's just been talking about, which is in contrast, I think, to that, you know, to the world which, you know, which one knows through European eyes. In sub-Saharan Africa, people in general, like, really do interpret things which are going on around them in terms which we would consider to be religious. So we found that for example, if you want to give somebody information about HIV transmission, I mean, how this virus is passed from one person to another, in the terms which people use on the ground, that provides a satisfactory answer to the question of how somebody got infected. But it doesn't answer the question of why they're infected, and it was in searching out the reason for why somebody's infected that people head into more into turf or into discourses which are more explicitly religious. I mean, this is always something of a surprise to those of us who are sort of trained in more sort of secular public health discourses. Like, the why and the how are things which we tend to conflate. So that was one, you know, that's one example of just a straightforward, like, result, which we think is pretty instructive, and can really help in both understanding what's going on and also in designing programs which more effectively cater to people's needs on the ground.
So, Jenny, can you fill out a couple of other thoughts there? Obviously, we have differences between types of religion, such as Islam, different sects of Christianity, such as Protestantism and Catholicism, etc. Are there any big headlines that you would be able to draw out as differences between the impact upon how those particular religions impact upon the prevalence of HIV, its treatment, etc., etc.?
Sure. In talking about, for example, prevention and HIV prevalence, I think one of the big headlines would be that we find fewer differences between religious groups than many people would have expected. And we think that there are a couple of reasons for this. One of them being that if you imagine rural African communities, you can imagine a Catholic parish, you can imagine a local Pentecostal congregation. In rural areas, because of this, how daily life is structured, and because of lack of roads and infrastructure and communications, many local congregations are pretty disconnected from their denominational authorities, and Catholic religious leaders in rural areas, for example, may have conversation partners that are their local religious leaders of other local congregations. For example, they may be in dialogue with the imam who is in charge of the mosque a kilometer away, and they may be in charge with the Presbyterian, in communication with the Presbyterian minister. And in that way, we find that messages from and the sort of context of religious groups, they tend to look similar to one another in geographic areas, more so than we would expect if we were thinking about religious congregations hierarchically and imagining that every local priest or pastor is carrying out the orders of their observing bishop or sort of more regional leader.
Exactly, so that, going further up the hierarchy.
Exactly. So sort of few few differences between religious traditions in terms of prevention, in terms of sexual behavior. However, we do find big differences in terms of the level of religiosity that people report, in terms of understanding their own sexual behavior, the way that they think about sex, the way that they think about prevention, and that does have consequences that, you know, demonstrable epidemiological consequences, where, you know, we find people with lower levels of HIV prevalence in areas among highly religious subpopulations.
So, I mean, just to fill that out, if I can. So one of the things which we did, which I think makes our data fairly unique, is that we've got this national or the sample of almost 200 congregations from which we collected data, including sending people to listen to and observe sermons, and then interviewing the leaders and asking them all sorts of questions about their own views and the sort of things which they like preach about, and we found basically that in those congregations in which the religious leaders are taking a much their messages related to AIDS are much broader. So they're both biomedical, you should use condoms and protect yourself, but they're also moral. Mm-hmm. Like you need to practice abstinence and be faithful, and they include sanctions for behavior which crosses those sorts of moral boundaries. In those congregations with both moral and biomedical messages, that's where we find lower rates of HIV. This is consistent with Jenny's message that the differences which one finds by religion are much less related to differences across traditions than to the congregational style, which is primarily a product of who happens to be leading it. Because there really is here, as in many other cases, there's a sort of divergence between what's the official discourse of a denomination and what a particular local leader who has all sorts of other things going on. I mean, there are also the seminars on AIDS which he could have attended. There's this tension between like the national leadership and the local. And that has these demonstrable epidemiological results.
And what about the role of morality? Because obviously religion is suffused with lots of rules about what is right and what is wrong. And certainly throughout the world, HIV has, especially in its early days, was associated with particular types of behavior that, you know, whether it was homosexuality or whether it was a form of you know, sexuality anyway, which obviously is much more the case in Africa itself. How did that feed into the debate? Because obviously it could also be seen as a punishment from God under certain circumstances. Jenny, do you want to answer this?
Sure, I'll take this one. In terms of the moral messages, we think that this is an important part of what religious leaders in particular contribute to how AIDS is being dealt with in communities. And as most Westerners would expect, religious leaders do have moral messages about HIV. They do talk about AIDS as a plague, as a punishment from God for the sins of their community, and they do preach messages of abstinence and fidelity on a very, very regular basis. This probably wouldn't surprise anyone who was imagining what the relationship between religion and AIDS would look like, but we find that religious leaders aren't only packaging moral messages. Moral messages are also accompanied by a variety of different kinds of messages. And as Alex already mentioned, we have religious leaders talking about biomedical approaches and talking, for example, about condoms, about getting tested in their community. So the moral messages are sometimes accompanied by very sort of public health sounding messages about biomedical forms of prevention, and these go hand in hand. And also religious leaders have very pragmatic messages about AIDS that are coupled with these moral messages. And so I think that those are two important ways of thinking about the way that moral messages are being delivered. They're not standing alone, but they're paired with and combined with other types of messages, and they come as bundles. And we found that some combinations of these are more effective than others in reducing HIV prevalence in certain communities. But importantly, on the moral question, one of the most important findings from our book is that Western perspectives, I think especially American perspectives, tend to think about morality as it relates to AIDS almost exclusively in terms of sex. And moral messages about AIDS go far beyond that. Moral messages about AIDS involve mandates and obligations to care for your sick family members and to visit your neighbors who have this disease, to participate in funerals, to give proper burials to members of the community that are being that have been lost due to AIDS. And the moral dimensions of AIDS are really not sex is just one part of it, and I would say, I don't know, maybe a third, maybe half, but it's not the whole story in terms of how religious leaders and religious communities see AIDS as a moral problem.
Alex, I thought I heard you wanting to chip in there. Were you going to add?
actually, no, you probably just heard signs of me sort of egging Jenny on. I was like, yes, good.
In which case, I'll chuck a slightly different question at you, and that is, it almost follows on from this question of morality. But did you find any particular patterns in the way that AIDS victims or HIV victims were stigmatized?
Yes, we certainly did, and this is one of the larger parts of the project where our results in general diverge from everything else. And what I mean is, like, it's only really when we come to matters of stigma and care of people with AIDS and their families that we find any significant differences between the various denominations which make up African Christianity and African Islam. There were very, very substantial differences here. In stigma, we basically found that when we control for all sorts of characteristics, education and age and so on, we still find much higher rates of stigma amongst Muslims in sub-Saharan Africa than amongst Christians. And this then corresponds to, and we think is a related causally to the even more substantial differences which we find between Muslims and Christians in the care of people with HIV/AIDS. So for example, in 2004, we in a survey of a close to 2,000 people. We asked all respondents if they had visited the sick during the last months, and all of the Christian groups, these averages, so whether one was like Presbyterian or was a Baptist or one of the evangelical churches, they were all roughly in the 30% range. So from 30% of our respondents who were Christians had said they had visited, and like amongst the Muslims, it was only 7%, and this is an enormous difference. And we argue that this is rooted in very, very different sorts of congregational structures. Churches, as we observed, basically, all of them have like a weekly collection for the sick. There's a committee, and many of them then straight after services they go and visit members of their church who are sick, who are too sick to show up, and they give them cheer or they give them love. Mm-hmm. There is nothing, or historically there's been nothing equivalent to this within the African Muslim tradition, even though there is still the same underlying norms of charity and helping people who are not family members. But it's that missing institutional layer which we think ends up having a very, very significant effect on people's lives. I mean, the difference between 30% and 77% is massive, and so it's the only way really in which we really found a substantial difference between these two major monotheistic traditions in sub-Saharan Africa, and I think it. I mean, we were surprised by the scale of it, given that both religious traditions have at least a discursive emphasis on helping the poor and the widows and orphans.
And one other thing that I was very interested in was the impact. Let's go back a bit. If we look at the various aspects of where HIV can be impacted upon, it's through things like prevention. It's obviously things like the cures, and things like giving comfort, as we've just been describing. Obviously, you found quite a big difference between a Muslim and Christian communities on that one. But one big area which I think fits into the prevention category is alcohol. And I found this was quite an interesting aspect of the book, because there is a very distinctive pattern of alcohol use in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa. And this has obviously been identified as many people who work in the HIV area have pointed to it as a real cause of some of the problems. Jenny, maybe you'd like to pick up on this.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Sorry, I was just going to say Jenny loves alcohol, so perfect question.
I mean, in terms of prevention messages, when we're following the sort of the public health agenda, we focus on three things, right? It's guided by the ABC campaign: abstinence and faithfulness and condoms. But in studying HIV on the ground, we learned very quickly that there are a number of other strategies circulating that people use, and that people advise, and in ways in which people advise each other in terms of how to avoid this disease, right? And alcohol use was an interesting one, and it was one that I think emerged as we were collecting this data. The idea is pretty simple. It's that people who are drinking heavily don't make as good of decisions as those who aren't, or as the same person does when they're not. And we have lots of religious leaders from traditions in which alcohol consumption is forbidden, and also within traditions where it's not explicitly forbidden, encouraging members to stay away from alcohol, also to stay away from drinking establishments, which are where a lot of sort of one-off sexual encounters, not only, but sometimes with sex workers, occur. And so this sort of wisdom of avoiding alcohol as sort of more fundamental prevention strategy, because avoiding alcohol is going to help you avoid risky sex. It was a message that came through very, 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 very clearly in multiple religious traditions. Even, for example, among Catholics and other groups that don't have any formal prohibitions against alcohol use.
If I can just add there,
please do.
I mean, one of the transitions happening in sub-Saharan Africa, and this is particularly true in urban areas, but one finds it reflected in trading centers in rural areas too, is as you have this, or as has been this rapid increase in the number of educated people, there's also been a change in consumption patterns. And a growing taste for like Western style alcohol as part of a growing taste for Western style fun you know, so you see posters in cities advertising the same sorts of products which are advertised in the first world cities. So, you know, cell phones and cars and all sorts of consumer items, and alcohol is one of those. So, you know, so on one hand, you have the appeal of this like modern, fun, middle class lifestyle for young people, which is, you know, drawing people in. And on the other, there are you know, there's the acknowledgement that, as Jenny has described, like with alcohol comes a slippery slope into all sorts of other like iniquitous
activities. Behaviors. Yes, behavior.
And some of these then becomes sanctioned by some religious leaders. So, you know, so we came across stories of like a local pastors who were, you know, who go to somebody's house and say, hey, you were seen in that bar last night. Why were you there? If you go there again, you will be sanctioned. And it's really trying to stop the slide. So somebody who gets drunk and ends up having sex with a bar girl.
Mm, absolutely. One other thing, which you're talking about the great transformations that have happened in Africa throughout this period of HIV infection and its prevalence across the continent. Obviously, urbanization is something that you've just touched on in that answer. But it strikes me that a lot of what you're talking about in terms of how religion affects you know, HIV in all of its dynamics, is very much based down at the village level. It's based upon how the dynamics of that religion work with that particular preacher, etc. We were talking earlier, and Jenny was saying how, you know, you're often divorced from the church hierarchy, so it doesn't really matter quite so much what the bishop says. It's what the guy in front of you says on the Sunday or whenever you go and listen to him. Obviously, with urbanization, which is increasing apace across sub-Saharan Africa, how is that affecting things? Because obviously that's access to all sorts of, you know, much higher up the hierarchy religions. You also have the growth of new religions that, you know, in enormous churches in some of the large cities and conurbations that are growing up across Africa. Is that changing the picture?
I think it absolutely is. I mean, one of the religious changes that's most visible across Africa is the rapid growth of Pentecostal and charismatic traditions across sub-Saharan Africa. We've seen it very visibly in Malawi over the course of, you know, the past 7 or 8 years. And the Pentecostal tradition has really taken root among this growing urban middle class, among young people, especially among more highly educated subsectors of the population. And one of the interesting things that's important to keep in mind about the Pentecostal tradition is that we do see lots of conversion to Pentecostal traditions by Catholics, by members of mainline denominations like the Anglican Church or the Presbyterian Church. But we also see people, especially young people in urban centers, who maintain their affiliation with the tradition they're from, with their Catholic Church, for example, but are participating in religious revivals and in sort of charismatic services that are taking place, sometimes spontaneously, sometimes planned, sort of youth rallies that are Pentecostal and charismatic in nature. And this is highly, highly visible in urban centers and in urbanizing parts of the rural communities and some of, you can call them the hinterlands, but these trading towns, for example, where people from rural villages spend time trading their goods and sometimes move to before a larger migration to one of the more typically urban centers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you know, on the flip side, even though people tend to distinguish in fairly hard terms rural and urban areas in sub-Saharan Africa, if you're following any given person, then there tends to be a lot of circular movement, and people are going back and forth, especially when they're unemployed or underemployed or working on temporary contracts, which is the way that many people live. So, you know, so they can go to a church associated with one denomination when they're at home in their rural area, and they can go to another one entirely when they're in the city. So people's like religious affiliation then is a little bit less fixed than we typically think of it.
Mm-hmm. Because of all these migration flows.
Yeah. There's just a constant flow.
And one other thing that obviously intersects with HIV and AIDS, but I'm not sure how it intersects with religion as well. Traditional medicine. Who's the volunteer to tell me about how traditional medicine fits into this whole narrative? No one.
Okay, I'll go.
Alex,
I'll
it go. Sounds like you.
So, you know, there's a whole subset of topics which people are instantly attracted to when they're doing stuff on health in sub-Saharan Africa. And in the AIDS literature, you see this with less now, but certainly during the 80s and 90s, you had lots of focus on exotic practices, so you know weird like marital relations and sort of sexual patterns in general. And then there was also this focus on witches, witchcraft, and then you know somewhat like related to that. Traditional healers. The big thing which we found, I think, is that there's still a lot of serious engagement with traditional healers, and the traditional healers are distinguished classically from witches, witchcraft, in the fact that they don't use any blood or the products of the human body. They just use herbs. So people will, in parallel, go to like traditional healers for a bunch of reasons. I mean, sometimes it's just like long established family tradition. It's easier to pay them because you can pay them in kind. You can pay them with like a chicken, which you can't do at the modern clinic. You know, the clinic might not have any like drugs, or will have a really rude nurse who talks down to these poor people because she's educated and urban and. So there are all sorts of reasons why people can use it, but sort of typically we found that there's parallel use of modern and traditional medical styles. It's not like people choose to go either one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sort of following what Alex said there, is that people are simultaneously engaging in, first of all, biomedical treatments from clinics, also traditional medicine, and also seeking faith healing from in religious congregations. And one of the religious groups that has distance themselves, or at least try to distance their members more explicitly from traditional medicine, has been the Pentecostals. There are messages specifically to avoid traditional healers from Pentecostals. Mm-hmm. But among other religious traditions, religious leaders sometimes encourage their members to see a traditional healer when they have when they have an illness, when they have symptoms that are not getting treated in clinics, and that's not uncommon. We also had at least two religious leaders in our survey of over 200 who doubled as traditional healers and religious mm-hmm. leaders. Some of religious leaders wear that very same hat.
We're drawing to the end of the interview now. I just had a couple of questions still to ask, one of which is obviously tying up what's in the book, and that is asking for some kind of conclusion, because obviously it seems like it's a mixed picture. It's a lot more complex than we might imagine when you first look at the intersection of religion and AIDS in Africa. So we'll start with you, Jenny, seeing as you were talking last. What is your big conclusion, or what is your big thought at the end of this book?
I think that in trying to understand the AIDS epidemic in sub-Saharan Africa, you know, in arguably the most religious part of our world, we just can't understand it accurately if we're thinking about it only as a medical problem, because that's not how most people in sub-Saharan Africa are experiencing it. We sort of argue in this book that people are experiencing it just as much as a religious and as a moral problem as it is a medical or a health problem. And I think that that shift in thinking about AIDS, specifically with a religious lens, not, you know, reluctantly, like, okay, if we really, really must, then we will, you know, decide to look at how religion shapes sexual behavior. You know, this was sort of one dimension. But in terms of a holistic view, I think one of the conclusions for us is that it's really impossible to understand AIDS in this part of the world without taking religion seriously. And I think one of the other parts is the assessment that everyone wants, you know, religion, is it more good or more bad, given that this is sort of a mixed bag when we're talking about different types of prevention, when we're talking about stigma and caregiving, and we have sort of two sides of the same coin in many of these different dimensions of understanding AIDS. But overall, I think the data is pretty clear that if you have to make the call, I think that religious traditions in this part of the world are contributing a lot more good than bad, and that is a story that's been overlooked by the Western media's portrayal of religion and religious leaders and religious people in this mm-hmm. part of the world.
Interesting. Alex, would you concur with that?
I certainly would concur. And I think there has been a transition as well in one thing which we haven't talked about today, but I think certainly Christian religious traditions in the early days of HIV/AIDS, there were a lot of mistakes made, I think, and a lot of things which I think devout Christians are fairly ashamed of. Now, but the empirical evidence for sub-Saharan Africa, I think certainly certainly the data which we collected are pretty clear that in general, I mean, there are exceptions, but in general the contribution is positive, both if you're talking about prevention and if you're talking about care. Central like result which I think I sort of came away feeling strongly about, and that the way that sub-Saharan Africa is often been represented and still is to some extent, it's in a very negative way. It's a place filled with disease and suffering and deaths and economic and political stagnation, and that same sort of story lends itself to the characterization of Africans as being somehow doing in an unreflective way the bidding of their culturally conservative leaders, whether they're political or religious. But One of the things which we find, and I think show over and over, is that people on the ground are much better than that. They're skeptical of all sorts of authority figures, and those authority figures are African and they're foreign, and people critically compare recommendations which they receive from all sorts of sources. And they generally try to figure out on their own, and I mean that you know, inside their communities, what are the more effective ways to do all sorts of things? And I mean, here we've been talking about minimizing infection and sort of dealing in the most sensible way with caring for people when the state doesn't have the infrastructure to be able to do it for you. So I think both Jenny and I came away feeling here much more positive about sub-Saharan Africa than we would have had we just restricted ourselves to the depictions of religion and AIDS which one finds in the mainstream press, or even in some of the public health literature where the bad guys are still, you know, the churches still the religious leaders who are burning condoms I'll leave it there.
And no, I think that that's a very, very good place to end it, simply because I think it reflects how much enlightenment there is to be found in the study that you did. I found it a very fascinating book about something that obviously is of such critical importance to the continent, and obviously also goes against some of the stereotypes and preconceptions that we have. So congratulations on the book, and as I think I warned you just before we did start recording, I would like to ask one little question of both of you, and let's start with you, Jenny. Do you have a favorite place in Africa, favorite place on the continent?
It must be Balaka, which is not the most beautiful place I've ever visited in sub-Saharan Africa, but where I've spent the most time and where I've cultivated relationships with our research assistants and with local religious leaders and vendors at the market, and you know, where I feel, I think, more at home than any other place in Africa. So I would have to say Balaka.
And how much time did you spend there?
You know, I've spent long and short stretches. You know, as long as 6 months with my family in tow, and you know, shorter month long trips here and there on many occasions. I mean, cumulatively, a couple of years.
All right. Excellent. So, okay, Alex, your turn.
I'm going to go for something completely different. I think my favorite place is a place I've only spent 3 hours in.
Yes, go on.
And only been there once, and just because it was completely different to anywhere else I'd ever been. And this is Skeleton Coast, which is
In Namibia.
Exactly. So about a couple hundred miles north of, I think it's called Swakopmund.
Yes.
And so this amazing place in the middle of nowhere where you can roll down a sand dune, which is 100 feet, 200 feet tall, and as you're rolling down, you hear the undercurrents of your body shifting the sand layers beneath, and you just hear the booming of the sand dune. I mean, it's an incredible place, but not for any social contact, because you're not likely to come across anybody there.
I think that part of Namibia is mainly full of tourists who are rolling down sand dunes. So, but it sounds as though it was a very good 3 hours.
It was amazing.
Okay, well, once again, congratulations on the book. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And thanks for joining us on the New Books for African Studies, Jenny and Alex.
Thank you for the
opportunity. Thanks very much.
And that was Jenny Trinitapoli and Alexander Weinreb talking about their book, Religion and AIDS in Africa. Remember that you can follow the New Books Network on Facebook and Twitter. But from here in London, have a good day.